then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 16th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Major League Edgar Steele update this week. On September the 7th, in federal court in Coeur d'Alene, Edgar Steele's wife, Cindy, finally stepped up to the plate, and legally speaking, she may have knocked one out of the park. Maybe, if we can get anybody to pay attention to what she's saying. That court date was supposed to be a plea bargain hearing for Larry Fairfax, the federal informant who manufactured a pipe bomb and attached it under Cindy Steele's SUV. Fairfax is going to get a sweetheart deal, which would basically allow him to do a few months of cushy time in a minimum security facility and then walk out the gates. Provided, of course, that his testimony convicts Edgar Steele, who's the real target of this bizarre little psychodrama from the age of Obama. What Cindy did was to use a little-known aspect of the law, the right of the victim of a crime, to file an official and legal objection to a plea bargain involving the crime committed against her. She and her mother, Mrs. Kunzman, both filed legal objections to Larry Fairfax's sweetheart deal in exchange for his testimony against Edgar Steele. In doing so, I won't say that they've blown the lid off the case, since the news media has been silent on it except for one article in the Bonner Daily Bee, and nobody has yet heard Cindy's story because of this media blackout. But they have given us far more information about what's been going on in this loathsome frame-up than anyone else so far. At long last, we're getting a glimpse at the inner workings of this sickening case. I might also add that Cindy only did this after the U.S. attorney prosecuting the case, a woman named Tracy Whelan, repeatedly refused to return her calls or discuss the case with Cindy. It became so glaringly obvious that Cindy was just being blown off by the government that she said, to hell with all this low-profile crap. Something's rotten in the state of Denmark here, and I'm going to start sounding off. The key words here are from one of the federal's own court documents describing Fairfax's criminal actions as part of the plea bargain deal. In fact, these words may be inadvertent. Some clerk typist in the U.S. Attorney's office or some dumb FBI agent who doesn't know how to write a report may have slipped up and let the cat out of the bag. I quote, "Fairfax and another individual, not identified in the documents, drove to Oregon to check whether the pipe bomb was still on her vehicle. They didn't see it and returned to Idaho, assuming it had fallen off." Now, this is the first word we've had of anyone else being involved in the alleged murder plot, and yet the FBI has refused to publicly identify or arrest the second individual. In other words, there was not one, but at least two federal informants involved in framing Edgar Steele. My guess is that the unidentified person was Fairfax's handler. Who knows, maybe John Doe number two in the Steele case was actually a badge-carrying federal agent. Now, what do you want to bet that this John Doe number two is made to disappear from the narrative just like the John Doe number two in the Oklahoma City bombing? Yeah, I know, that doesn't really apply, since the identity of the Oklahoma City John Doe number two has been known for years, but you folks understand what I mean. In her objection to the judge, Mrs. Steele demanded to know who Fairfax's accomplices are so that she can protect herself from them. She wants them brought to justice, which is unlikely if the kingpin Fairfax is allowed to get off easy. Now, here's where it gets nasty. According to Mrs. Steele's affidavit, at the time of her husband's arrest, the FBI told her that there were still multiple accomplices of Larry Fairfax and her husband, Edgar Steele, quote-unquote, out there, allegedly circling like sharks waiting to kill her, and that was why she had to go into hiding, never speak to the media, and why she, above all, must never, ever attempt to contact her husband or ask him what the hell's going on. Now, I've been wondering about that. when a woman who has been married to a man for 30 years and all of a sudden she's informed that her husband has allegedly tried to hire a hitman to kill her, you would think that the first thing such a woman would do would be to march right in and demand some kind of explanation or at least hear his side of the story. You'd think after 30 years she owed him that at least. Now, Cindy Steele apparently didn't, and for a while that puzzled me. Well, now we know why. The Federal Bureau of Investigation frightened the living bejesus out of her by conjuring up images of assassins with sniper's rifles and silenced pistols in her closet and hiding under her bed. Also, a comrade of ours pointed something out, and that is that the federal court's no-contact order is, in practice, mutual. It's just that. It's not a restraining order. It's not an Ed mustn't contact Cindy order. It's just what it says, a non-contact order. And Cindy can't contact her husband without violating the order herself. In other words, Cindy is just as much prohibited from talking to Edgar as vice versa. Steele himself is now facing an additional 10 years in prison for sending his wife a birthday card and for speaking to her on the phone in a call that was set up by the authorities, especially to incriminate him. The regime wouldn't even allow the two of them to meet for a discussion of their financial affairs, or such financial affairs as they have, since the regime seized and froze all of Edgar Steele's assets so he couldn't hire a competent attorney. Now, somebody sure as hell doesn't want Edgar and Cindy Steele getting together and comparing notes. Now, that was one of the first circumstances that led me to believe that there really is a frame-up going on here. If the government's case is really so solid, and if they have Steele banged to rights on these alleged audio and videotapes soliciting the murder of his wife and mother-in-law, then why do they need all this skullduggery? Why not bring in Cindy Steele for a big confrontation and videotape the whole thing? Their so-called evidence can't be all that convincing if they're afraid that Steele might persuade his wife of his innocence simply by talking to her. Now, here is Cindy's version of events as explained in her affidavit. And by the way, these affidavits are available for your inspection and edification online in PDF format. Now, the URLs are too long and complicated for me to read out loud here, but I've posted them on my blogs, and you can email me directly at nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll send them to you. In late May of this year, Cindy Steele took an 18-day journey from her home in North Idaho to Portland, Oregon, to be with her mother, who's been ill. In the early morning hours of June the 11th, 2010, the FBI went to visit Mrs. Steele there. The same day, they arrested her husband on so-called evidence supplied by Fairfax, the man who actually planted the bomb and who was allowed at that time to remain free. However, according to the affidavits of both Cindy Steele and her mother, instead of warning Mrs. Steele that they had a report of a bomb under her car, the FBI agents sat outside the house for 2 hours for unknown reasons. Now, remember, the official story was that Fairfax had supposedly come forward on June the 8th all on his own, allegedly filled with horror at the thought of being solicited to commit murder, and so you'd think that the FBI would have been aware of the pipe bomb at the time of the visit. But they neither checked under the car for the bomb themselves, nor did they call the Portland Bomb Squad, nor did they have the car impounded so it could be inspected. Instead, Obama's finest allowed Cindy Steele to drive 450 miles back to North Idaho with a bomb under her car, where, on June the 15th, she pulled into a Jiffy Lube, and the attendant pointed out an object attached to her exhaust system, a pipe with some wires and several sticks of dynamite. Not a black powder pipe bomb as originally claimed by the FBI and the media, but a real-life dynamite job of the kind the mob refers to as tailpiping. Now, that's another piece of disinformation spread by the media, but contradicted by the actual court documents. The local bomb squad was called in to neutralize the device, and U.S. Highway 95 had to be shut down for several hours as the bomb was blown up in a controlled detonation. So yes, it worked, and it would have killed Cindy Steele or anyone riding in the vehicle. Why didn't the FBI in Oregon take immediate action, not only to warn her, but to neutralize the bomb? If the bomb had detonated in a populated area when Mrs. Steele hit a pothole or other obstruction in the road, it's possible that many people would have been killed, and yet the FBI did nothing. The only thing that they've come up with by way of an explanation is that Larry Fairfax, forgot to mention during his debriefing that he'd already wired dynamite to Cindy Steele's car. That's a pretty big oops there, Larry. Do you believe that? I don't. I think those federal agents knew perfectly well that Cindy Steele's car was rigged to explode, and they deliberately left it so that Cindy would be killed, and that would lend credibility to their case against the husband Edgar, who is their real target. I think the FBI and the U.S. Attorney have received orders from the Obama regime in Washington, D.C. to get Edgar Steele, and they don't care how they do it. After all, a dead Cindy Steele couldn't gum up the works and throw a monkey wrench into the system by believing in her husband and filing inconvenient affidavits in court now, could she? Something really off kilter is going on here, and I'll be honest, I don't fully understand what it is. What puzzles me is the fact that Ed Steele wasn't really doing anything when they arrested him. He was recovering from serious major open heart surgery. He was weak as a kitten. He was diddling around with the idea of running for governor of Idaho, but he had already given that up, and he announced the same on his blog, if memory serves. The one motive that appears possible is that Steele was about to publish a book on the Israeli sex slave trade. It's pretty much well known in world law enforcement circles that Israelis are the biggest pimps around. And it's possible that that book just really pissed off somebody in world Jewry. Who knows? Why would the government enter into a plea bargain with a confessed criminal whose accomplices are at large when the FBI allegedly believes they still want to kill the victims? The government routinely makes deals with mobsters like Joe Barboza and Sammy Gravano who've killed dozens of men. But I admit, I've never heard of anything as blatant as this happening before. Why is it that these other individuals, whom the FBI told Cindy Steele exist, have not been charged with a crime, since the U.S. government claims to know who they are, including the one who accompanied Fairfax to Oregon to check out whether the pipe bomb was still on her vehicle, and who was clearly knowledgeable of the crimes being committed by Fairfax? Why is the U.S. government protecting the identity of a co-conspirator who has complete knowledge of the entire scenario and who was physically present when a very important part of the crime was being committed? Isn't a co-conspirator someone who offers assistance, such as helping Fairfax check on the bomb? I think the answer is obvious. At least one of the so-called other conspirators is either a long-term federal informant or a badge-carrying FBI agent who was acting as Larry Fairfax's handler, and they don't dare reveal his or her name. Fairfax was about to lose his house in foreclosure. He stole thousands of dollars of gold and silver bullion from Edgar Steele while acting as his handyman, and he needed a way to cover up those thefts. But then again, maybe Fairfax had another source of income. There have been a number of inconsistencies in the dribs and drabs of evidence that the FBI has allowed to leak out, which indicate that Fairfax was already a longtime federal informant when he first met Edgar Steele, and that he may have been sicked on Steele deliberately with a view towards framing him on some kind of fabricated charge. The Obama regime is clearly trying to break Edgar Steele. After Steele's arrests and after two phone calls, which appear to have been arranged by the government in order to incriminate and entrap him, Steele was held incommunicado, in isolation, without visits from friends or family for almost 6 weeks. For some weeks, the Spokane County Jail denied that Steele was even there, and they told a number of people, including myself, that the U.S. Marshals Service had taken him away to an undisclosed location. It's still not known whether Steele was in fact removed from the jail and taken elsewhere for a time, since he hasn't been allowed any uncensored or unmonitored communication with anyone. A public outcry and a letter and phone campaign from Mrs. Ingrid Castle of the Idaho Observer to state senators and representatives finally forced the government to reveal Steele's whereabouts and allow him correspondence and visitors, although right around that time the Spokane County Jail mysteriously changed their policy so that inmates can now only receive postcards. Another interesting thing recently came out. Cindy Steele has fired the attorney she had and is in the process of looking for a new one. One wonders whether her previous long silence was due to bad legal advice she was getting, and who was actually signing that attorney's checks. One final note. Both the affidavit from Cindy Steele and the ones from her mother are couched in the required legalese form, and yet they contain pointedly favorable references to Edgar Steele. It's easy to read between the lines. Cindy and her mom don't buy the Fed's wild story about Steele hiring Larry Fairfax as a hitman. So that's one question answered. Cindy Steele and her mom are standing by their man. Now that's the first good news in this foul case since it started. As to who the unnamed accomplices of Larry Fairfax are who remain at large, I think it's fairly obvious. They're federal employees of some kind, informants, or possibly even badge-carrying agents. Hence the mysterious inability of the mighty and infallible FBI to apprehend them. If I were Cindy Steele or Mrs. Kuntzman, I would be a hell of a lot more afraid of the FBI than I would be of Edgar Steele, sitting alone and isolated in his prison cell and dependent for his defense on a paid employee of the very system that's trying to destroy him. Right, first email from Gerard in Missouri. Dear HAC, what do you think about the Koran burning over the 9/11 weekend? Well, I don't think it's quite as silly as the media made out, although they sure did their best to turn it into a circus. There is such a thing as symbolic speech, after all, and although, as some of you know, I'm inclined to cut Muslims a little bit of slack because of the way they've been so hideously victimized by the Jews, I have to say that building a mosque at Ground Zero says a lot about what kind of country this has become, that anyone in America would even consider allowing such a thing for a moment. But, hey, whose fault is that? If white Americans are weak, is it the fault of the Muslims or Jews or other non-whites that they take advantage of that weakness? Why shouldn't they take advantage of a weak and confused enemy? Or is it our fault for being weak and confused to begin with? Now, I did find it intriguing that no one in the media, from AP to Matt Drudge, dared to show any images of an actual Quran burning. The reason for this is simple and shouldn't be lost on any of us. The Muslims have an armed deterrent. We do not. No one in the media dares to insult the Muslims publicly because there is at least an outside chance that they'll be held personally responsible for their arrogance and their presumption. The media insult and ridicule us all the time because they know that it's perfectly safe to do so and that nothing will happen to them when they do. Now, if that should ever change, and if a situation should ever arise where individual journalists and editors and owners of media outlets believed that there was at least some chance they might be held personally accountable for their behavior, then I think we would all be amazed at the change in the coverage that white nationalism receives. No more Jerry Springer show for us if that ever happens. Right, first music break. I've been sending out the Aryan History series again over my email, and one of the chapters in that series is simply the text of an old Woody Guthrie song from the First Depression called Pretty Boy Floyd. Charles Arthur Floyd was one of the great 1930s bank robbers and nomadic-type gangsters. Now, these guys were more like traditional bandits than proper organized crime like the Capone mob in Chicago. Some of you may have seen the recent movie Public Enemies with Johnny Depp playing John Dillinger, which takes a lot of poetic license with the facts, but otherwise it's not too bad of a flick, especially if you like older firearms like I do. Now, let's be honest. Most of these guys were pretty scummy. Most professional criminals are, and some, like Babyface Nelson, were simply homicidal maniacs. Bonnie and Clyde were flamboyant, and they had a lot of spectacular escapes and shootouts, and they went out in a bloodbath that made a great movie scene, but as hoods go, they were penny ante. They mostly robbed filling stations and grocery stores, and most of the men they killed were unarmed. But Pretty Boy Floyd was something of a horse of a different color. To some degree, he was a genuine Robin Hood type who shared his loot with the poor Okies and sharecroppers he grew up among, and he never had any hesitation in taking on fully armed opponents face on. In 1929, he's believed to have avenged the murder of his own father by killing a man named Jim Mills, although Mills' body was never found. In Kansas City, Missouri, on July 22, 1931, Floyd faced down and killed an ATF agent in a traditional Western gunfight. And in 1932, he shot it out with the sheriff of McIntosh County, Oklahoma, and killed him as well. On June 17, 1933, Floyd and a fellow gunman named Adam Ricchetti attacked a party of five armed police and federal agents in the train station at Kansas City in an attempt to rescue one of their gang members from custody. They used Thompson 45s and killed four of the lawmen, although, unfortunately, the guy they were trying to rescue was killed as well. Well, Tommy guns were never exactly a marksman's weapon. The feds finally caught up with Floyd on October the 22nd, 1934, in a cornfield in Ohio. J. Edgar Hoover's fair-haired boy, Melvin Purvis, shot Floyd in the back, just like he'd done with John Dillinger 3 months before. Looks like the FBI hasn't changed that much. I guess Lon Horiuchi at Ruby Ridge was just carrying on an old Bureau tradition. But Floyd made quite an impression on poor white folks at the time, and his name lives on. This is The Byrds.
Well, gather around me, children, a story I will tell about Pretty Boy Floyd, the outlaw. The homer knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee on a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in a wagon is into town he rode. Then along come a deputy sheriff in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language his wife she overheard. Then Pretty Boy grabbed the long chain, the deputy grabbed the gun, and in the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. And he ran through the trees and bushes, he lived a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. He ran through the trees and bushes on the Canadian River shore, and many a starving farmer opened up his door.
was on a Christmas day. A whole carload of groceries with a letter that could say, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Well, here's Christmas dinner for families on relief. Through this life you travel, you'll meet some funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. It's through this life you ramble, it's through this life you roam. You'll never see an outlaw take a family from your home.
Well, folks, it's Dutch Uncle time again. I got a few admonitory emails over my closing rant last week when I was exhorting you all to quit screwing around and get your asses in gear and come home to the Northwest right away. The general upshot of these was that I was rude and crude, I was being bitter and mean, and I was going to upset and alienate people and make them feel bad about themselves, and therefore they would stop listening because I was wounding their sensitive spirits by demanding that they get their asses in gear and come home. I was once again informed that I can catch more flies with honey than I can with vinegar. Well, that may be true, but I'm not trying to catch flies. I'm trying to change the world. I have an increasingly limited amount of time to do it in, and I have almost nothing to work with by the way of resources or human material. So yeah, I get kind of testy at times. Although I'll say this much. I'm sitting here babbling at you guys while looking out my window on a bright and sunny morning here in the Puget Sound. I've got the window cracked so I can feel the cool fall air, and I can see the orange and silver of the leaves turning outside, and I can see Mount Rainier under a blue sky in the distance. Now, maybe if some more of you would come here on a scouting trip and see that for yourselves, then I wouldn't have to rant and rave so much. I myself can't imagine why anyone would not want to live here. Guys, look, if I had a carrot to offer you, believe me, I'd hold it out to you, but I don't, so I have to use the stick. I genuinely wish that there was a proper Northwest agency up here similar to the Jewish agency that's handled Jewish immigration to Israel for over a century now, but there isn't, not yet. That's high on the agenda for money and personnel and resources when we get any. But somebody's got to go first, and that's what I'm ranting and raving about on here every week. Until that happens, we're pretty much up the creek without a paddle. A lot of people want to know why I don't just wave my magic wand and convert all the local white people who live here to the cause of Northwest independence. Then they can provide the support system and the safety net and set out the picnic tables with all the cakes and ale so the rest of you can sashay on in nice and easy and without any problems or risk. Now, the first most obvious answer to that is that there is no magic wand, but there's more to it than that. You ever heard of priming the pump? I'm sure that there are guys out there who are real people persons, nascent George Lincoln Rockwells, who are quite capable of coming out here and jumping on a picnic table in some public park and giving a rousing speech to the passersby that immediately inspires them with revolutionary fervor, and they all march on City Hall and proclaim the Northwest American Republic. No kidding, really. I'm convinced that there are people like that alive today. Somewhere out there is our own Northwest George Lincoln Rockwell, but he hasn't been located and motivated yet, and that's one reason why we have to get this thing here up and running as soon as possible, so that when he is located and motivated, we'll have some place for him to go and something for him to do. I can't do this alone. I have to have you guys help. I'm not getting anywhere near enough of it, and so I rant and rave a lot. I need you here, and that is absolutely our bottom line for the Northwest migration. There has to be a Northwest migration, meaning that you have to actually migrate here. I'm not able to bribe you to do the right thing, so I have to try and shame you. It's better to do the right thing for the wrong reason than do the wrong thing for any reason. So when you hear me shouting and pounding on the table telling you to get your asses up here, just remember, it's not me yelling at you. It's history yelling at you. It's the voices of our forefathers yelling at you and telling you to man up and get this done. It's destiny yelling at you. It's the voice of God yelling at you, if you want to put it like that. And no, I don't claim to speak for God, but I have a desire for our race to survive combined with common sense, and I think so does he. Right, now for another installment of what's going to become a regular feature on Radio Free Northwest, and I call it Back to Basics Time. Movement people of my generation kind of assume that we all share a basic canon or foundation or common knowledge and experience, but we don't, not anymore. When us ancient codgers were coming along, we learned what we needed to know from books, but since the internet replaced books, a lot of those strands of knowledge and common experience have been broken and replaced by cartoons and Facebook. Newer and younger white people in our circles simply don't know a lot about who's who and what's what, especially when it comes to the past of our own movement. I referred just now to the possibility of our locating and motivating our own Northwest George Nick and Rockwell, and I'm sure that most of you understood who I was talking about. But I have a horrible suspicion that some of you listening to this broadcast didn't get that reference at all, and that has to be rectified immediately. There's no excuse for any white man or woman or child in North America not knowing who George Lincoln Rockwell was. Rockwell is the founder of the present-day racialist movement in the U.S. and the founder of American National Socialism. George Lincoln Rockwell was our St. Peter. Just as St. Peter brought Christianity to Rome and made sure that it became a universal religion and not just a local cult in Palestine, Rockwell took a localized, or at least European-only, racial doctrine, Adolf Hitler's National Socialism, and he brought it to the center of the known world at the time, the United States, and made sure that it became a universal creed of white salvation. George Lincoln Rockwell was born in Bloomington, Illinois, on March the 9th, 1918. His father was a successful comedian and vaudeville showman named Doc Rockwell. Rockwell grew up around actors and theater people, including a lot of Jews, so it can hardly be said that his so-called prejudice later in life came from ignorance. At age 18, Rockwell entered Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, majoring in philosophy. In college, Rockwell did well in the sciences and other objective courses, but he fought blindly and instinctively against the sociology and other similar departments, which even back in those days were heavily infiltrated with liberals and Marxists who were preaching environmentalism and equalism and all the other crap which has played such havoc with our race and our nation since then. When World War II came, Rockwell enlisted in the United States Navy. He got into naval aviation and became a fighter pilot. He served aboard the USS Omaha in the South Atlantic and off North Africa during the invasion, ironically fighting the very Nazis he would later embrace as the champions of our people. He was sent to the Naval Photographic School for pilots and assigned to the USS Wasp, and from there he went to the Pacific Theater. He became a commander of forward air control operations for Marine Corps assault troops. He saw action at Guam, Okinawa, and other Pacific hotspots. At the end of World War II, he was commanding officer of a squadron in Hawaii. During the war, Rockwell earned 9 decorations, 2 of them for valor in combat. After the war, Rockwell attended Pratt Institute Art School in New York, where he discovered his talents as an artist and cartoonist that were later to stand him in such good stead as a political leader. Rockwell was recalled to active duty during the Korean War in 1950. He trained Marine and Navy pilots in close support of troops, and then he was transferred to Iceland, where he became commanding officer of a squadron at Keflavik. At about this time, he became deeply concerned about the way all that he had fought for in 2 wars was being turned over to communism. He noticed that almost all of the convicted communist spies and traitors and most of the communist intellectual leaders of his day were racial Jews. He was especially shocked to find that Who's Who in World Jewry, published by the Jews themselves, listed many of these atheist communists very proudly as Jews, even though Rockwell then believed Jews were nothing but a religion. Rockwell knew that Hitler had said that communism was Jewish and that the Jews were out to degenerate and conquer the white race through subversion and race mixing. Rockwell bought a copy of Mein Kampf and read it, even though he thought he already knew what was in it from all he'd heard. But he was astounded to find that it was actually a brilliant analysis of the mess that Western civilization had gotten into, and the only plan he'd ever seen for the white race to save itself. Now, for a number of years, Rockwell tried to work with various right-wing organizations, all of whom believed, as he did for a while, that it was necessary to disguise one's belief in Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. Finally disgusted with the emptiness, the weakness, and the hypocrisy, and especially the cowardice of the so-called conservatives, Rockwell determined to attack at last, flying the swastika banner which had come so close to saving Western civilization and the white race once before. Rockwell said, and I quote, "Since our cause is fundamentally the truth, I don't see how we can win by lying or misrepresenting what we are for fear of the Jews. The only time in the 100 years of the rise of communism that this plague has ever actually been beaten, it was beaten not by conservatives, but by radicals and fighters whom the enemy called Nazis and fascists and whom they really did fear. Only in Germany, Spain, and Italy has communism ever been conquered. We are damn fools to be afraid to follow the only examples that ever worked." End quote. Rockwell formed a small group, which he called the American Nazi Party. He hung up a swastika banner in front of his home, and he dared the Jews to do something about it. The publicity gave him a much-needed platform from which to call the attention of his fellow Americans to the increasingly desperate situation of America and our great white family of peoples. Rockwell believed that it was time for the white man to take America back from the aliens, the minorities, and the terrorists in power under the demagoguery of cheap politicians. To accomplish this, Rockwell believed he had to win not the few in the right wing or the upper classes, but the millions and millions of our people. And we need to understand that about Rockwell's career, that he genuinely believed in a mass movement of whites. And to be fair, in his time, in the 1960s, something of the kind might have been possible. 50 years ago, white people weren't nearly so weak and confused and morally corrupted by Jewish brainwashing as they are today. It was still possible to raise a good old-fashioned white mob on occasion. And given adequate financing and skillful handling, a genuine mass white resistance movement might have been a possibility. Within 5 years, Rockwell had led the American Nazi Party from a tiny and scorned band of roughnecks willing to take to the streets to fight treason and race mixing to a party that had headquarters in Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles, and most major cities, and commanded the grudging respect of the enemy even though there was powerful censorship of the American right to know of what Rockwell was doing. Under Commander Rockwell, the party published the Rockwell Report, the Stormtrooper, and the National Socialist World, along with bulletins for party members only. Rockwell had plans to organize the White Guard, young white fighting men to help protect society from black and red revolution, which was already conquering the police departments of Los Angeles, Chicago, Cleveland, and many other cities. Rockwell lived a shadowy existence on the fringes of the American political scene. He was misunderstood and rejected by the vast majority of his fellow white Americans, whom he loved dearly. He and his tiny band of roughnecks were alternately cursed, ridiculed, and ignored by the mass media. They fought street battles without end against communist and Jewish thugs who sought to silence them by force, and they spent many a night in jail, courtesy of hostile politicians and police officers. But throughout it all, Lincoln Rockwell's warrior spirit of courage, idealism, and heroic defiance was never crushed. His years of persistence finally paid off in 1966 when thousands of white men, women, and youth in Chicago followed his leadership in a spontaneous uprising against efforts forcibly to integrate all white working class neighborhoods on the South Side, specifically a place called Gage Park. The uprising culminated in the now famous White People's March of September the 10th, 1966, in which hundreds of whites followed Commander Rockwell's leadership under the sign of the swastika. I was 12 years old at the time, and I remember Chicago that summer. It freaked people out. It was kind of a white version of all the hippy-dippy McCarthy crap that took place in Chicago 2 years later. Tragically, within a year, Lincoln Rockwell was dead. On August the 25th, 1967, this American hero was murdered in Arlington, Virginia, under circumstances that have never been satisfactorily cleared up, but which, I have to say, point very heavily towards the Jewish Anti-Defamation League and also to at least some involvement on the part of the man who seized control of the Nazi headquarters and, quote-unquote, succeeded Rockwell. The trigger man was later convicted and received a short prison term, but his accomplices in the corridors of power and the traitor within the headquarters who made the phone call telling the gunman where Rockwell would be were never charged or punished. Yet although Lincoln Rockwell died on that dark Friday in August, his heroic spirit lives on in the hearts and minds of white men and women everywhere who continue to draw inspiration from his mighty example. Now, on a personal note, I want to add that Lincoln Rockwell inspired an entire generation of young white men to take up the cause of their race and to stick with it throughout their entire lives, including myself, of course, but also men like James Warner, Dr. William L. Pierce, Tom Robb, Ralph Forbes, James Mason, Robert Brannan, Alan Vincent, Brits like Cullen Jordan and John Tyndall, Australians like Eric Ray Wenberg, who was killed in Rhodesia, Americans like Richard Biederman and John Coey, who were also killed in action in Rhodesia. There was my first party CO, Joe Tomasi, Joseph Paul Franklin, Art Jones, even David Duke himself, although you'll be hard put to get him to admit it these days. Now back in his wild and uproarious youth, Don Black even took a bullet for the old party. Long story, that. I'm not completely sure on this, but if memory serves, even Tom Metzger dabbled in the old ANP back in the day in Southern California, along with the mystery writer James Ellroy, who referred to that time of his life in his autobiography. And then there was the movement's first post-war female martyr, Kathy Ainsworth, who was murdered by police in Atlanta, and who was the model for Kathy Frost in my Northwest novels. That's another name nobody remembers today. Oh, and you remember a name from my novel The Brigade, Machine Gun Mike Gauss. He was real as well. So were Slugger Tiny Knowlton and Wild Man Mooney, who was my first team leader in El Monte. George Lincoln Rockwell left behind not just a political and an ideological legacy. He left a human one. And those of us who remember may yet crown his life and his work with victory before we're done. In his memory, here's a song from Rockwell's time, and yes, I'm old enough to remember this one. Okay, now I need to deal with a serious question that's come up in a lot of emails and also during a lot of personal visits and contacts with new people and not so new people. The question is, okay, suppose we all do as you ask, Harold, once we get to the Northwest homeland, what then? Of course, the first thing that a new white settler needs to do after he arrives home is to get settled in, get employed, get to know his co-workers and his new neighbors, and start sinking roots into his community, and as near as possible, begin living a so-called normal life. You need to make sure that you don't come across as odd or eccentric or violent and criminal or anything that'll put people off. Remember, you're representing the Northwest Front and the future Northwest Republic, and you need to act like serious adults and make people respect not just you, but the ideals that you stand for. The first thing you have to do if you want to change people's minds and convert them to your point of view is to place yourself on a credible basis of communication with them. And you can't do that if they think of you as any kind of oddball. Now that's why I've got reservations about things like excessive or blatantly racial tattoos and skinhead regalia. For a number of reasons, new Northwest racial settlers need to be able to blend in. Nobody, friend or foe, should be able to pick you out of a crowd. Also, you should stand ready to help other incoming migrants. You need to remember that a lot of the things that the party will ask of you will revolve around providing a safety net, resources, and other assistance for more incoming migrants. And of course, the more people we have settled in a primary settlement area, the more newcomers we're going to get as the word gets out that there's some place for white people to go. But at some point, we're going to have to come out of cover and begin public, local, political organizing for independence on the ground here in the Northwest itself. And that's when the exciting and the fun part starts, also the dangerous part. That's when the media and the feds won't be able to ignore us any longer, or should I say pretend to ignore us any longer. Local organizing is just what it sounds like, local organizing. Although there will be primary settlement areas, of course, there should ideally be some kind of NF presence in every city and town and rural area in the homeland. Building a network like that is going to take a massive investment of time, people, resources, and hard work. Which is one reason why we have to get started on it now and quit sitting around behind our computers waiting to be entertained every week by Radio Free Northwest. Revolution is not a spectator sport. This is a subject I'm going to be returning to time and again on here, but right now we need to get started with some of the basics, and that's some of the propaganda and educational tools we'll be using. We will need purely local Northwest Front websites like the one the Kalispell PSA has already put online. But while the internet is all very well and good, you can't organize political change purely with a personal computer. We have to take it back out into the real world. For that purpose, we're going to need a lot more small, non-internet items, such as business cards, stickers, leaflets, brochures, half-size flyers, you name it. a lot of our initial political work will consist of the same sort of thing our groups have been doing for a couple of generations, mostly simple literature distribution. But unlike in the past, the NF is going to need follow-through in the form of human contact. Anyone who responds or expresses an interest needs to be able to meet real live human beings to talk to and develop them politically and racially. And that means someone nearby so they don't have to drive to Seattle or Kalispell or Coeur d'Alene to meet their first real live Northwest Nationalist. We will need local spokesmen who are willing and able to take the heat, and those unit leaders are going to need support systems for when the system tries to crush them, as the system most assuredly will. And we'll need lone wolf-style organizers who are willing and able to live and operate alone in small Northwest towns, sometimes for years on end, and spread the message. Now, these lone wolves will be the true heroes of our movement's early years. They will have to take upon themselves the responsibility of bringing the message of Northwest freedom to their home localities all on their own, at least until they can recruit their own crew. They'll have to meet and cultivate and assess other nationalist recruits and eventually activate them and get something besides words out of them. The psychological pressure that these single organizers will face will be tremendous, and we already know from experience that a lot of our people, and I don't mean weak or incapable individuals, for whatever reason just really can't hack it all alone. Now, this is why I advise them to read John le Carré and other spy novels by way of psychological preparation. Lone white nationalists of any sort need to develop a spy's mindset. They need to think of themselves as agents operating behind enemy lines, which is exactly what they are. Now, the main focus of all Northwest Front organizing will have to be the local unit. We will eventually have a general headquarters, the purpose of which will be to provide backup and support for local units. Neither I nor anyone else, though, can become some kind of fearless leader who carries all the responsibility and shoulders all the risk. The Northwest American Republic will stand or fall on the amount of local support that we receive from the actual white people who live here. And the key to that support won't be websites or some kind of communication from on high, but the work and personality and presence of the local Northwest Front guy who lives just down the street in every white community in the Northwest. Those are the guys who have to carry the weight, and those are the guys who are going to have to be respected and listened to by the locals. I know that there are a lot of people who are living outside the homeland who feel left out, and when all this fun stuff starts up here in the homeland, they'll still feel left out. Well, you can still help. I mentioned before that we need all kinds of small, handheld items like business cards, stickers, leaflets, pamphlets, so forth and so on. And we don't have anywhere near what we need. In every introductory packet of party literature, I include a series of instructional and propaganda leaflets, and of course, local organizers can always reproduce those. But let's face it, those are kind of dull, long blocks of type with all kinds of big words in them. We're going to need small and short, colorful items, preferably with a Northwest tricolor flag on them, because white people in the Northwest need to learn to recognize their new nation's flag. Now, I've said before that everybody who's associated with the Northwest Front is expected to contribute something other than words. Well, here's your chance. I want you to show me what you can come up with on the web and on your own home printers by way of small items like business cards and stickers. Small knick-knack items like novelty pens and so forth are fine as well. Now, we now have a storefront on the northwestfront.org site where you can buy tricolor t-shirts and baseball caps and NVA coffee mugs and such like. But if you want to design your own things like that, great. Then once you've designed your card or your sticker or your knick-knack or whatever, send me a sample of your work and I'll see if it meets our standards. And then I'll tell you to start producing as many of them as you can. We simply don't have the money to produce large quantities of printed or other items for bulk distribution. We're going to have to make up for that through dozens and hopefully hundreds of individuals producing their own Northwest Independence literature and souvenirs and stickers or what have you. Every item you make should at least have the northwestfront.org website on it and the Seattle Post Office box as well if you have room to fit it in. Now, here's a few hints. We are really short of stickers, but they need to be printed on vinyl or something weatherproof because ordinary sticky paper, the kind you buy in Office Depot, runs in the homeland rain. Also, a sticker or a business card or other very small item needs a slogan like White Homeland Now or White Freedom in the Northwest, something like that, because you have to give people an idea of what the Northwest Front is about, and it should be racial, not just Northwest Freedom or anything like that. Now, we don't want people confusing us with those hippy-dippy Cascadia idiots. Third music break. I had a query this week asking me what our Radio Free Northwest theme song was. It's called The Rising of the Moon, the classic rebel song from the 98, as they call the 1798 rebellion in Ireland. After the 1916 Easter Rebellion and the subsequent War of Independence, the 98 probably produced the best rebel songs. Here's another one from the 98, and this is Hair of the Dog.
Twas the morning in July, I was walking to Tipperary. I heard the battle cry from the mountains overhead. I looked up in the sky, saw an Irish soldier laddie. He looked at me quite fearlessly and said, "Will you stand in the van like a true Irish man? Will you go and fight the forces of the crown? Will you march with O'Neill through an Irish battlefield? Or did I ever go and free old Wexford town? Said I to the soldier boy, will you take me to your captain? It'll be my pride and joy for the march with you today. My father fell at Cork, my son him in his Carthy. To the noble captain I did say, will you stand in the van like a true Irishman? Will you go and fight the forces of the ground? Will you march with O'Neill through an Irish battlefield? Or did I go and free old Wexford town?
Sometimes people ask me what the funny-sounding slogan is that I close these podcasts with. The words are Sarsha an de Bann, which literally translated means freedom to the white, or white freedom. I suppose I should say freedom to the white race, but I do remember enough to know that race in Irish is fianna, which can also mean clan or tribe, and is a little too fuzzy for my liking. I might go with Thram, D-H-R-E-A-M, but number one, I think that's a Scots Highland Gaelic word, and number two, I'm not completely certain it's correct. My pronunciation is even more tricky and might not be completely correct as well. I never spoke the language well enough to learn the rules of grammar, and Irish pronunciation is weird to begin with. In any given written word, you don't pronounce about half the letters. For example, the name for Dublin in Irish is three long words, which I won't spell out, but it's pronounced simply Balaclia. The written BH is pronounced V, and the S is sibilant, as in the Irish for Belfast, Valfirsta. I think I got that right. MH is pronounced V as well, so Galway in Irish isn't Galim, it's Galiv, so forth and so on. TH at the end of a word is usually silent, but in some dialects like DC's, which is the Munster Irish, for some reason dating back to the Bronze Age, it's pronounced N. So when I sometimes tack an N on it, as in Sarsha an den Bann, I'm not necessarily wrong, it's just a coin toss. By the way, if there is an honest-to-God Gaelgwar or Irish speaker out there, some guy who wears the fania, and if you know all about this, please correct me. No offense will be taken, believe me. Internet resources on Irish aren't really very helpful because you cannot learn pronunciation phonetically from written words, at least not worth a rat's ass. You have to hear it spoken. But why do I use Irish at all? Well, partly it's because I remember living in the last years of the old Ireland before it became a colony of Nigeria, and I remember the thrill I got every time I heard the language spoken on RTE or saw an Irish sign in the street, knowing that it was a direct connection more than any other Aryan tongue with a heroic past that we can't even imagine now. You see, Irish, being a language for an isolated island people, never got all that modernized and slangified and corrupted with Yiddishisms and booga 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 like, for example, American English has done. Partly, it's also a way of thumbing my nose at the Jews, because Leopold and Molly Bloom notwithstanding, of all the nations of Europe, up until recently, the Irish were the least corrupted and the least Judaized. Sigmund Freud once said that the Irish were the only people on earth who were not susceptible to psychoanalysis. Basically, Ireland was always so poor that there was nothing to steal, so the Jews pretty much kept away. But when I was casting around for an Irish slogan, there was one that popped into my mind which would fit us to a T. I won't try to spell it, although I'll email it to anyone who asks, but it's pronounced Chucky Arla, our day will come. But I rejected that one because the IRA has already co-opted it, and we have a lot of British supporters who already think I'm sailing too close to the wind with all this Irish stuff, and who would be genuinely offended, and I certainly don't intend any such thing. I won't go over my Irish apologia again, which I've already covered in several previous podcasts, but suffice it to say that yes, I know the Provos are communists, and yes, I know they kill innocent people, many of them British, and I know they annoyed the hell out of Londoners for years by constantly shutting down the tube and the buses. They annoyed me as well. You British listeners, in your turn, need to understand that of all the past and present situations for the past 100 years or so, the closest political and strategic parallel to the plight of white people in the United States is that of Ireland. And let's face it, it's a proven model. It works. The IRA never formally defeated the British, true, but they forced Tony Blair to buy them off. Nonetheless, I agree, Chucky Arla is a bit too Provo-like for comfort. We can adopt their strategy, and I personally have no problem at all in stealing their rebel songs for my books or for real when the time comes, but given their habit of blowing up babies and prams and kneecapping and torturing anybody they don't like just for the hell of it, and bombing pubs and discos full of completely innocent people and shooting unarmed men in the back, I don't want the Provos too closely identified with us. If and when an NVA ever does appear in real life, I want our men to be true revolutionaries and soldiers, not blood-drunken psychopaths. So we can't use Chucky Arla as our Irish trademark, which is a pity because it's a good one and a slogan of hope. Chucky Arla, our day will come. And it will one day. Nothing lasts forever. Let there be no doubt, this society, this existing order, is going to come to an end, almost certainly within the lifetime of those now living, including some of us listening to this broadcast. Some of you will have the wonderful privilege of seeing it end. And even if it ends in fire and blood and mass destruction and a heap of rubble, at least it will end. Finally, finally, praise God Almighty, it will be over. And no matter how bad that end is, whatever is left of the white race can start over. And if we have to start over with sticks and stones and wearing animal skins, then it will be worth it. Just so long as we finally get these goddamned kikes off our backs. I recall Oliver Cromwell's words 350 years ago to the British Parliament as he dissolved it by force. Go, I say, ye have sat here too long. Someday, somebody is going to say just that to those 535 yay-saying leeches in Congress and to some dolt in the Oval Office. Go, I say, ye have sat here too long. With any luck, whoever the lucky bastard is who gets to say this, he will speed them on their way with a baseball bat to their noggins, and with any luck, we won't have to start over with sticks and stones and animal skins. With any luck, the white race will make a collective decision to bring this filthy world and the filthy people who run it to an end in a deliberate and controlled manner, and save something of our 3,000-year-old heritage and civilization for our descendants. I would very much like the people who accomplish that feat to be us. I would like to see that process begin here in the Pacific Northwest with the establishment of a homeland for all our people worldwide where we can live in safety and spiritual health, where we can heal from the wounds and the sickness that a century of Jewish rule has inflicted on us, where we can replenish our numbers for a struggle that will someday bring about the true Imperium. Chucky Arla. What do you say we quit tap-tap-tapping on computer keyboards about all this stuff and start doing it? What do you say you brush up on your resume tonight, start sending it out to Northwest employers tomorrow, and then start calling the van lines and getting moving quotes? It can be done, you know. Chucky Arla. We can free our race. we can secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We are Aryans. We can do anything, because for all our many faults and weaknesses, and for all our dumb mistakes, we are still better than they are. And that's the name of that tune. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anuban. Freedom.